From Edge Radio 99.3 FM, this is an edit of The Dice Men Cometh, the podcast.
The Dice Men Cometh!
Good evening, everyone. Check your watches. You'll find it's 7 p.m. on a Thursday evening, and that means...
It means I've done 11,686 steps. Unfortunately, it also means my resting heartbeat is 102.
It also means that you are here in the Edge Radio studios in Hobart with The Dice Men Cometh with myself, Mark.
I'm Garth.
And myself, Leon.
And look, let's take a moment. We'll just wind this down. Let's take a moment to pause and reflect. The air here in Hobart is heavy with smoke. We know there's some big, serious fires down in the Huon Valley, and our thoughts go out to all those people that are affected by fires. I know there's a lot of people in Hobart who are not coming to work, who are home preparing to defend their homes, preparing to evacuate. It's a fairly serious time now. Only a little bit of property damage has been done, and luckily no lives lost.
Correct.
But depending on what the weather does, who knows what's going to happen. So our thoughts certainly go out.
Well, look, fire is a mysterious beast. And I do recall being stuck down on the Tasman Peninsula about 4 or 5 years ago when the Denali fires were on, and we couldn't get out for about a week. Yeah. We were down there for a couple of nights, and we were under no illusions that if it all turned horrible, we had to swim to a boat, because that was the boat of our neighbours, and they would then figure us out. It was scary, so I tip my hat first of all to all the fireys who are putting their lives on the line every single day to keep property, people, everything safe. Because I would hate to see those board game collections go up in flames.
Yeah, it's a real life version of Flashpoint. I would not like to deal with at
Correct.
The moment.
And especially, the problem is,
especially a copy of Flashpoint that we play, because we are the worst.
Yeah,
that's right.
Not and even the cat gets out.
Cardboard burns so easily.
Yes, and minis don't look good once put fire to them.
Correct. No, so, right. What episode is this, and who are we, and why are we here, Mark?
This is episode 249. So close to a milestone here on the 31st of January 2019. Tonight we're going to talk about it's a hotness, not a fire. That is Keyforge Call of the Archons. We're going to have a little bit of a chat about our experiences with that, and then we're going to visit the side of the table that we don't often visit, but we love it so much. That is role-playing games, RPG. We're going to have a little bit of chat about, Leon, your D&D campaign. And Garth, our Call of Cthulhu campaign.
Oh, yeah.
If that doesn't take us to the end, I'm sure we'll find plenty of other things to talk about. But in the meantime, we'll take a bit of a break, and we'll be back shortly.
With the Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3 FM. I trade my heart for your
heart, baby. Give you all my kiss. Hi, this is Ella from Ella Loves Board Games, and my favorite podcast is the Dice Men Cometh.
Edge Radio 99.3 FM with the Dice Men Cometh, and that was Lainey Lane with, you would not guess it, Bang Bang was the name of that song.
And I think, by the way, for anyone else who's suffering from prohibition, because that song sounds like it was straight out of the 1920s.
Yeah. Oh, come on!
It was a belter, though. I must say I enjoyed it. Now, we're going to talk about that Keyforge game that's been, like, big in the world and whatnot.
So Keyforge, eh? Keyforge is designed by this little-known, independent, nobody-of-nobody game designer called Richard Garfield. Now,
hang on, isn't that his secret identity? We shouldn't give that away.
Now, Mark is dying to make an Andrew Garfield Spider-Man joke, and I'll let you go. You can do it. That's absolutely fine. But we're real gamers. Real gamers. Has there been a good Spider-Man game? So if there hasn't been a good Spider-Man game,
not a
why
game,
would we know
sure.
about Spider-Man and who he is and what he is? So, look, Richard Garfield, pretty fair to say, is the man. In board gaming. Everyone who's everyone and anyone and even no one's and everyone who's gamers will know that he designed Magic the Gathering.
Yes, that small little game.
But he's also done, let's just say, a lot of other games. Leon, do you want to just rattle off some of the games that he's designed?
Well, he's done Android Netrunner, which is probably the second best long-running card game behind Magic the Gathering. He's done King of Tokyo, which is arguably the best family slash want a party game everest.
And one of your favourite games, full stop.
It certainly is. He did Bunny Kingdom, which was one of my games of the year last year, as well as some older things like he did the Battletech CCG back in the day, did Robo Rally, the original version.
I think that's pretty amazing, sort of that program movement style game.
Yes, indeed. And yes, he's also the designer of Keyforge.
I know.
So what is Keyforge and why should we care? Well, Keyforge is the first ever unique, non-deck-building, fight-em-smash-em-up game that's ever existed in the planet. The reason that is important is because there's a whole bunch of backstory and lore that goes into the creation of the world that is Keyforge, and I'm not going to bother with it because I couldn't be bothered reading it because it was all kind of hodgepodgey, I don't care. You're all archons, which are godlike creatures in this random place doing random things. The point is you are all there to lay down some smack, and that is exactly what you will do in Keyforge. Keyforge is a two-player game which is all about collecting delicious, delicious amber or amber, perhaps. I kind of feel like they had to go for some weird writing just to make it sound a little bit more interesting because, again, don't know, don't really care about the world. What I cared about was getting some decks to be able to play this hottest of hotnesses because already it's touching the top 200 on the BGG list. When I checked earlier today, it was 217. But in this category that I didn't even realize existed, it is number 7. And the category is something like customization.
Right.
And I think it's Arkham Horror or Arkham Horror LCG or something like that is number 1. So basically games where you can modify the stuff that you use to play the game, it's number 7.
Why is this game in that category? Because you can't modify this.
No, but every deck is already modified. So look, what is it? Who is it? Why is it? I'm not going to go into backstory because I don't know and I really honestly don't care. And I truly believe that most people who will play this game also will not care the backstory about this game.
Well, Magic the Gathering's been around for over 20 years and it took a very long time for that to start producing things like books and that kind of to fill in the back lore, which is actually really interesting and they create entire worlds. But even that most serious Gathering fan couldn't care less about.
Correct. So, look, this rulebook comes in at a hefty 26 pages, but the last 10 pages or more are all about the lore and the history. Haven't read those.
No.
Don't really care.
But that's still a lot of pages. Hang on.
It's also on a virtual rulebook.
Is that 16 pages of rules?
Well, no.
For a 30-card deck game?
Well, we haven't even got to that yet.
35. 36. No, I don't know.
Keyforge is, as I say, little two-player game. Where you sit down and you open up your own personal deck. And the reason it's your own personal deck is because no one else will have that deck. And I don't mean no one else at the table. I don't mean no one else in the state. I don't mean no one else in the country or even the hemisphere. I mean no one else in the world. Because what makes this unique is that the deck is yours. The configuration, the makeup of it is entirely all yours and no one else on the planet will have that same configuration of cards that you will find in your deck. Now, it's made up of various races. You've got Mars and you've got Logos and you've got the Brobnar and you've got the Dis and you've got a whole bunch of others. I believe 7 at the first round of the Archon.
7 different factions. Archons, 7 Archons. Different factions, houses. And isn't it there's 50 cards per faction for a total of 350 cards. So far, I've heard the word, in this universe, and obviously you only get a certain number, Garth, in your deck.
Mm-hmm.
How many?
Let's say 27.
Three houses.
You get 12 of each, plus you get your little info cards.
So 36 cards in a deck. Which is quite a small deck, actually, for a deck-building game when most of them usually have sort of between 45 to 60.
That's not important, Mark.
It is.
It's not important because what is important is the fact that your deck is your own.
It is. It even has its own name, which is completely unique to you. Now, I have heard there are some names out there that shouldn't really be out there because they sort of threw a number of words into a database and said, hey, Mr. Computer, make some deck names.
Yeah. But it's not only deck names, it's also the icon on the back.
On the back of the deck.
Yeah, it's just all completely unique to you. So what? What is this game?
What is it?
It's going to be a two-player fighting game where all you're trying to do is get amber. The reason that you want to get amber is because if you ever, ever get to six, you'll get to forge one of these keys. And the reason that's important, well, the game's called Keyforge.
Ah.
Now, the first player to forge three of these keys will win the game. And that's why this game is not a creation game. It's not a synergy game. It's really a race game to get to 18 amber, or at least 6 amber initially.
Yeah.
And then hopefully 6 again, and then hopefully 6 again. There will be things that will modify the number of amber that you need. So, what are you going to do? The first thing you're going to do, if you're the first player, is draw 7 cards. If you're the second player in this two-player game, you're going to draw 6. The first player is going to go, oh, look at these 7 cards I've got. I'm going to do precisely one thing.
Mm.
Because you only get to do one thing when you first play. You might want to go and do that thing. You clearly can't forge a key, which is always going to be the first step of any particular turn. You have to have 6 amber. You will definitely have to forge. That is the rule. The next thing you're going to do is declare what house that you choose to use. And this is probably the second most important part of this game, because in your hand you will probably have one of the 3 houses, because every single deck that you've got will have 3 houses listed in it, not 2, not 4, always 3. You have to declare one of those, be it Logos, be it Brobna.
One of them.
Be it Dis.
And so on and so forth.
When you declare those 3, that means you can basically do anything and everything you want, but only with that particular house.
And the reason for that is, unlike Magic or your Netrunner or majority of card games, is that you don't have any mana or power or action points to use or whatever else. You just assign that house, and then whatever cards you have in your hand or on the field or whatever for that house, whether it be 1 or 25, they will go and do their thing.
And look, let's say that is a huge point of difference, I think, from this to so many other living card games, collectible card games, trading card games, because as an old school Magic player for quite a few years, the mana curve, how many of those stupid trees and stupid planes you put in your deck that you hope will come out on turn one and they never do.
Yeah.
So many times you are screwed over. So many times you get that big beefy character, but I need 6 mana to play it. And can I get 6 mana even by the 6th turn? No.
Yeah.
So many times that is what is controlling what your deck is doing and not what you want it to do. This game does not have that problem.
No, which is amazing. Everything is nothing. You can play as much as you want. It costs you 0 as long as it's the one house you've declared. You can discard the cards and put them in the discard pile. You can play them. If they're already on the table, you can activate them. You can fight with them. That's kind of about it.
You can do all of those things. You can reap. It sounds so great. You can reap.
Well, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
So, what are you going to do with the cards once you've tabled them? You can choose to reap, as you say, which is basically tap them and get a free amber.
Yeah.
Amber. Really, really, really important, because you need 6 of them to build your first key forge and forge that first key. You can fight, which means that you're going to lay the smack down on your opponent, which can just be a reason to have a fight and kill something. And the only reason you really want to do that is because that card's probably got an ability that allows the other player to get some amber.
Yeah.
Or they've already stolen some amber from you, because cards can capture amber, which doesn't help the person who's captured it, because the amber goes onto the card that has taken it. But what it does is put your amber plans in the bloody Khyber Pass. That's what right. I do.
How many times, boys, how many times were you sitting there on six amber going, yep, going to forge that key next turn?
Yeah.
And some creature steals that one amber that you need.
He has
and
a name,
start
Mark,
your term on five.
He's sitting right there calling
yeah,
him a creature.
Yeah, he is.
So you can do that, but really, the cards will all do stuff, and it's pretty basic. Look, there are a few key terms that you've got to be aware of because it does make or break the game. The joy of this is there is a very handy online rule book because there is no physical one, so you can always just have your phone handy and be able to look up any of these key terms like hazardous, for example, which just are a little bit of a tweak to the standard rules. We're not going to go into that right now. You're going to do stuff with the aim on your turn of activating as many or as few cards of the one house that you want, hopefully ending up with more amber than you started with. You'll then untap any new cards that you manage to play down because all the cards that you decide to place on your turn start tapped.
Unexhaust, Garth. It's Tap's trademark to magic.
All right. Well, Richard Garfield created magic, so yeah, surely we can talk about this.
Do Fantasy Flight own magic?
I was going to say, I'm assuming he probably doesn't own it anymore.
No. Wizards, is it still Wizards of the Coast? No. Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, I can't remember.
So far away from
such
that.
Insight.
But yes.
You untap your stuff.
You unexhaust.
You refill your hand to six, and then you let your opponent do some stuff. Fresh. And they're going to do the same thing back to you, all with the explicit goal of getting more amber and stuffing your plans up because with each of these seven houses that come in the base set, they all have different strengths and different combinations that work out better. So the Mars faction, for whatever reason, they work really well when you've got a whole bunch of other Mars cards out. You've got the Brobnar deck, who are arguably the best at laying physical smack to the opponents.
Yeah, they're the big beefy creatures.
They're stupid, but they know how to fight, and that's super, super important. They all just do different things, which makes each deck refreshing and different. But does it make it fun? Let's get to that. So this game sells itself as a two-player rock'em sock'em robots. You're fighting versus someone else. You're all trying to get amber and forge these keys. Sounds quick and fun and like you just want to do it again and again and again, doesn't it, Leon? All right, Mark.
Now,
doesn't it, Mark?
Well, let's turn away from the three of us and our esteemed opinions for a moment. Let's turn to the man himself, Richard Garfield.
Oh, does he not like the game?
To see what he has to say, because people have said, you know, that the moguls at Fantasy Flight called up and said, Richard, we need a cash cow. Can you deliver? Or something along those lines. His reply to them and to other criticizers online. I have been working on this game for many years. Before I approached Fantasy Flight Games myself, I was personally so excited about the concept, I flew myself out there and presented it, wherever Fantasy Flight is, unsolicited. People get to know their decks much better than a typical draft or sealed deck tournament. He's obviously comparing it to Magic. And people get more invested in the best way to use their resources. There is something very subtle which goes on with Keyforge that wins some people back in the end from turning away from Keyforge, which is that the mechanics lead to a style of play which isn't entirely unlike customizing on the fly. Now, the reason for this is the fact that you refill your hand every turn, and when you run through your deck, you reshuffle. Now, unlike many, many LCGs, CCGs, TCGs, when you burn through your deck,
done.
That's it. And in fact, in some games, if you burn through your deck before the end of the game, that kills you. In Keyforge, you just shuffle and keep going. So you refill your hand, you run through your deck, you reshuffle and continue. This means you can dump cards that are unimportant in one matchup and effectively sideboard them out. Now, that's a term from Magic where you've got some extra cards, you've got your 60-card deck, and you're allowed to have a 15-card sideboard, and then between games, you can swap between those two. So you're effectively sort of fine-tuning your deck between games. What he's saying is you're doing that as you're going. Now, the only cost of that is a bit of tempo, not the crushing cost in most games of the card. Now, on the other hand, you can sprint through your deck to reshuffle and draw that card that is the absolute killer again in cases you want to include it effectively in your deck and have it come up more and more and more often. So that's what he's saying, is you do have the ability in this to just chuck out those cards that are no good and get back to the good ones. And there's not a lot of penalty. You can throw out 6 or 7 cards per hand in this game.
Well, theoretically, yeah, you can. And yes, you can sort of siphon through your deck a hell of a lot quicker. But the reality is the game should be very quick.
Yes. It feels like it should.
If you're doing that, the game should be very quick as well. But the problem is it's not. From all of the games that I have personally played, and I've played it with both of you.
Yep.
I've also played it with my son. I've probably played 10 games or so of it in the last couple of weeks. None of these games has come in at less than 45 minutes, I reckon. Mm. Most of them have come in at well over an hour. And the reason for that all comes down to that last bloody key on the last player's side, where all you're doing is trying to prevent the inevitable.
Yeah. By that point, you're just like, well, I know I've got the cards that will take one of his amber, and he's got the cards that will take one of my amber and increase the amber I need to make, and back and forth and back. I mean, it says that the game's balanced well, but that, which for, you know, for the fact that it's all random generated cards, is quite insane.
Well, it can't be. By the nature of it all being random, it can't be.
Yeah, some decks have to be better than other, which we should talk about for the tournament that once the decks get...
Yep.
Once the deck has a certain amount of wins under its belt, it will get banned from all tournaments forever.
It'll ascend.
Yeah, so one of the reasons why Richard Garfield was so big on this game was that he basically, with Magic the Gathering, is he hates the fact that there is your Black Lotus is worth $10,000 and people are just like, oh, I would sell a kidney to get that card, and just like, that's not what the game is about. And the fact that you've got some people that are just like, no, I just like collecting all the cards and selling them on and making a profit off them, just like, that's just disgusting, really. You can't really do that with this. You could have the best deck of Keyforge in the world. If you win a local tournament with it, or two, it's going to get on a special list, and it's going to be worth... It'll be nice to play with, but you'll never win a tournament with it because it'll be banned.
Yeah, so I love the fact that they have got two styles of tournament play here. One is the, as you say, you bring your deck and you fight, and whoever wins, good luck to them. But the one I'm interested in, and I still believe that the three of us should go to a local tournament when it exists and do this,
mm-hmm.
which is the sealed deck.
Yep.
You just turn up, you pay your entry fee, you get given a sealed deck, and that's what you're going to play with. I like that idea. I think that is a really interesting way to run a tournament, full stop. I think that's a cool way, and obviously it ties in perfectly well with the fact that every single deck is unique in this particular game, but it, in essence, levels the playing field. It is not the deepest pockets wins.
In the same article where I quoted Richard Garfield before, he did talk about the fact that he loves... almost the opposite of what you're talking about, Garth. He loves the league when you play against the same people with the same deck, perhaps for a week, perhaps for a month, and you get to know your deck inside and out. And the difference between this and, say, a Magic deck is, a Magic deck, you could go away and you could go, I know Garth, and I know he's going to play that bloody...
That Black Lotus.
So I'm going to go and buy an anti-Black Lotus card that destroys all Black Lotuses, and I'm going to get 4 of them, and that'll fix him. And in this, you can't do that. In this, you have to understand your deck and drill into it and know, okay, this card and this card and this card, they've got to go together. I need them within a hand of each other, and I know if I'm not getting that, I've got to burn through my deck more and get them back. And it's more about the skill of the player that's playing the deck and less about how much I can afford to spend on it. And he loves that idea that you would put so much effort into understanding your deck and how it works and what's the perfect way to work. But then there's the also there, and I can't think what the name of this tournament is, but the tournament where, Garth, you and I play. We play the first game. At the end of the first game, we swap decks. And then you play my deck and I play your deck. I don't know what happens for the third deck, whether you swap back.
Oh, we probably just combine our decks and cut them in half.
But the fact that it's not about who can spend the most money. It's not about who can spend hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours building a deck. It's about I've got 35, whatever, how many cards. I've got so many cards. And that's all I've got, and I've got to make the best of that.
Yeah, looks like you want to say something.
No, I was just going to say that the third game, you each play a solo game with your own deck and watch each other.
Solo game with your own deck is never pretty.
Yeah, and then you watch each other.
So, look, I mean, the reason I'm attracted to this game is because I really enjoy deck builders, but I do not enjoy deck construction.
Yep.
That's the thing I liked the most about Magic the Gathering.
See, I hate sitting down and going, all right, well, I want four of those and two of those and three of those. Oh, but now I'm two cards over. What am I going to get rid of? Oh, I need one of those and one of those. Oh, now I'm five cards over. What? Okay, well, I need to get rid of those because they don't work well with each other.
Have you heard of Summoner Wars, Garth? I should recommend it to you.
Yes. I don't like deck construction, and I love the fact that there is none of that in this. You can pay your $15 or whatever the decks may be selling for, and you can actually compete.
Yeah.
Whether it be competing with your mates or competing in a tournament, you can actually compete. You've got arguably as much chance as anyone else.
There was a reason why my Magic decks always had 67, 68, 69 cards, because I couldn't make those tough decisions of which of these three cards should I drop out. Oh, I'll keep them all in. They're all so nice. But of course, that means you have less of a chance of drawing the cards you need. And I was terrible at deck construction. I loved Magic so much because I loved the cards. I loved the way they work together. I loved the collectible nature of it. But I was hopeless at deck construction.
Yeah,
and this takes that out of the picture. I agree. I love that idea.
I was just going to say, the thing I want the most from this game in the future is simply a YouTube documentary about how they actually physically make this game. Because as somebody that works in a factory, the idea that you are making these things and they're all unique, it quite literally boggles my mind. I do not know how this has happened.
Well, the fact that in the first iteration, which is 350 cards, has something, 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 quadrillion possibilities.
104 quadrillion or something like that?
Yeah. Anyway, it's not our problem. Our problem is playing it.
Well, look, I've got a question. Starter set.
No.
Do you need a starter set? I mean, I know technically you do, but
no.
Our experience is obviously we bought two decks each.
Well, that's because you can't get the starter decks at the moment. They just are out of stock everywhere, which is, again, a great problem for Keyforge. But, yes, we didn't get it. Now, the reason that you'd want it is because it comes with two vanilla decks that are in the boxes, which teach you the rules of the game and teach you some of the keywords that you will need to learn if you don't know how to read a rule book. They also come with the tokens. They come with the power tokens. They come with the amber tokens. They come with the three keys that you need to forge. But it's like $60 or $70 Australian dollars.
Yeah.
Which is the same price as 3 to 4 decks of the actual game.
Yeah.
You don't get a rule book in the physical starter set.
Which is, I mean, come on now.
Yes. So my answer is no, you don't need it. There are lots of decent apps out there which do allow you to essentially play the whole game without any kind of additional cardboard, with the exception of when cards take some damage. So if I've got a card that's got 7 health and it takes 3 damage, how are you going to track that? That's where tokens can be handy, but so can a couple of bits of ripped up paper. You can always make it work, and well, we've done that in the pub.
I was going to say, we played at the pub the other night, and I happened to have a copy of Jaipur, and it had the Jaipur chips, and we just used them. We used some of them for amber. We used amber, and we used some of them for damage. Look, I'm just having a quick little look on Board Game Shopper here, and it seems like, you know, between sort of $55 and $65 is about what you can pick up the starter pack. But as you said, given it's their vanilla decks and they're all the same, it's a lot of money for some tokens.
You pay a lot of money for a once-off game, which is these are the two basic decks and it'll teach you the fundamentals, which you will never, ever play with again. You then each have another unique deck in there, so that's kind of cool. But you're paying a lot of money for some cardboard chips.
I'm very surprised there's not some form of aftermarket kit where you buy your two decks and you buy this kit for $20 and it's got your Aimba markers or whatever they are. But I guess you're right. The apps do a perfectly serviceable job.
Yeah, I'm sure.
None of which are official apps, by the way.
Yeah, I'm sure they probably will be one of those sooner or later.
Anyway, we better keep going. Look, there's going to be a very robust app community on this because every deck has its QR code. You can upload your deck so that it is trackable online and you can see how many commons and how many rares and how many da-da-das you've got, which will be useful and important in tournament play. But at the moment, you can track your wins, you can track your losses. That's about it. I think we're done with Keyforge. Keyforge is a game that is fantastic in idea and I love the unique nature of it. But I want it to be a 30-minute and less game, and none of my 10 or so games have experienced that.
No.
Well, the one thing I wasn't aware of is when I was reading about it, is very carefully buried in the fluff was the first iteration. So clearly there's more houses,
yeah. There's
more cards. If there's 104 or 40 or whatever many quadrillion combinations, then all of a sudden they go, time for session two, and they bring out a new one. How do you balance that?
I don't know.
You can't.
It's very hard to say.
You balance it by ascending. And on that note, where the Dice Men cometh, it's Edge Radio 99.3 FM. We're going to come back with some role-playing goodness.
Garth, I'm so glad we've got to finally come and check out this restaurant.
Oh, yes. You mean the restaurant that the mayor of Eatsville invited us to come and eat at?
Well, it's all to do with the famous head chef. I mean, have you seen this menu?
I've only heard about it. Please, just tell me what it's all about.
Well, you can get sausage rolls. What? I mean, how Australian is that? You can get hot dogs. You can make a sandwich. You can get pizza. You can even have a burger. Although I noticed no beetroot, but it's got everything else on it. Oh, look, here comes the head chef now. Chef, chef.
Oh, hello.
Funding on Kickstarter now. Head Chef is an amazing little Aussie card game produced by Sea Star Games and designed by Peter Cricciola.
Yeah, so in this game, 1 to 4 players, because there's a solo mode mark.
Oh.
Can play in multiple different ways, where you can play as individuals, you can play 1v many, and you're going to be trying your darndest to become the head chef of the restaurant in Eatsville. You're going to start with a food truck, you're going to hopefully satisfy all these orders that you'll need to make to finally turn that food truck into a cafe, and then, should you be the most skillful head chef of them all, your restaurant will be the number one.
And this game scratches quite a few itches because you've got hand management, you've got action selection, you've got resource collection, all in a beautiful little card game, lots of lovely art, you've got a whole bunch of extra rolls you can use which change it up a little bit, plays in 30 minutes or so. We actually had a surprising amount of fun for such a relatively simple game.
Absolutely.
Lots of replayability. As we said, it's funding now on Kickstarter. It's well over halfway funded with still 20 days to go when we're recording this. So if you want to get behind a great little Aussie Kickstarter, a great little Aussie game company, and a great little Aussie game...
Well, it's got to be Head Chef, hasn't it?
It's got to be Head Chef.
On Kickstarter now.
Back it.
Well, there you go. That was The Cranberries with Wanted. You are with the Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3 FM. Now, from one conversation about a whole bunch of different races trying to lay the smack down to each other, we go to role-playing where Leon, your troop of people is probably playing a whole bunch of different races.
Yes.
Trying to lay some smack. down.
On other, but we're doing it cooperatively. That's the difference. We're doing it together. So I wanted to talk about the D&D campaign that I'm involved in at the moment. That is, as of, I think, the end of March, so about 2 months from now, we'll be going for a solid year, which in this day and age, with most D&D campaigns, is quite a rarity, getting this people. And we're talking a DM and six players here.
Yeah, six players is a big number.
Yes, well, our DM, John, has been playing ever since, like, second or third edition, so he's been doing this for quite some time. So I just want to tell everybody a little bit about the characters in the game that we've been playing. So
now, just quickly, can you give us, for any new listeners or any listeners new to gaming or role-playing in general...
Yes.
What does D&D mean?
D&D is Dungeons & Dragons, which is the most famous role-playing game in the world that has been around for about 40 years by this point, where it is set in a fantasy world. So think your Lord of the Rings, think your like Final Fantasy video games, you think your Warcraft, that kind of idea. So it's a world with your elves and your dwarves and your goblins and your orcs and so forth and that. And the game, you have a dungeon master, and he is the person that designs a story. And like, think of it as you're reading a book. Say you're reading a Harry Potter book to your child. Imagine if you could say to your child, "Now, I've just told you that Harry has come up against this magical beast. What would you do if you were Harry?" And then
Expelliarmus.
And then we would say, okay, well, it's kind of just boring to say, what would you do? And then you succeed every time. How about we roll some dice in the middle to see if you actually did it or you didn't?
Variability.
And that's pretty much how you play a role-playing game in general.
Indeed. But you have more funny voices.
Yes.
Occasionally a drink or two thrown in there if the group is so inclined.
Nice.
And a whole bunch of fun.
Yes. So the characters that we have in our little band of group, which is known as the Reckoning Crew, by the way.
Is that with a W?
Yes. Because we're just that kind of cool. So we've got six characters. We have my wife, who is Jade Smoke. She is a tabaxi bard, gifted with the curiosity by the Cat Lord. Just like her grandfather, she grew up listening to his stories.
Aww.
So my wife gets to be an actual cat lady. In D&D and in real world.
Yeah, that just sounds
it's not a big reach, to be honest. It's her first time playing D&D, so it's not a big reach for her to just to be a cat lady and go after shiny things, because that's her in a nutshell anyway.
I think the best thing was we actually ran into you on Tuesday night while Mark and I were playing a couple of two-player games, and you had your group there, and Sarah just turned up with a full face mask.
Well, that's because she has...
Fully in character.
Well, it's because she has pneumonia at the moment. That's nothing to do with her character, very, very sadly. Then we have my friend Josh, who plays Silas, who is an elven ranger with a quick temper, often seeking conflict resolution through violent outbursts. And he has a healthy disdain for the undead. He cannot rest in the presence of rotting flesh.
Who can, really?
Well, he can't. He's definitely one of them. We don't actually know why he hates the undead so much and why he's such a brooding Batman type, but we are getting there. Then we've got Vasilius Ironclaw, or Vess, if you will, who is the sole human in the party of this diverse creatures. He is a sturdy monk who fights for the balance in the world.
Okay, and who's that?
That is my friend Adam.
Uh-huh.
Or he's also my cousin, who I've known since I was born, because we is relatives.
Well, everyone is in Tassie.
Yes. All right, our friend Sam plays Chasm with a Q, who is a small gnome who was stolen from his home by forest bandits when he was a child and sent into slavery, but he was saved by a kind wizard who took him in as his apprentice and taught him everything that he knows. So now he's venturing forth in the world to learn more arcane ways.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, as one does. Then we have Monshon, the half-orc, who grew up with orcs, so is very rough around the edges. She is a barbarian who enjoys making things go splat. And then we have my character, who is Luther Wandering Hands Ugg. He is a...
Hashtag me too.
He is a Goliath, and he is also a paladin. So he is a big monster that likes to... He doesn't like to kill things, but sometimes he has to with his giant sword that does much, much damage. But what he really wants to do is basically just protect his friends and learn as much as he can so he can take it back to his people and help heal them and save them.
How many lay on hands have you done this campaign?
Oh, I've laid so many hands. Every session is just me laying hands. And I've always tried to come up with creative ways to do it. There's been many a high fives and two sweets and fist bumps that have given people back lives, or I just... I just use my hand to palm somebody's face. Especially good with Chasm, considering my hand wraps all the way around his head and can even pick him up holding him like that. So, yeah, that's good. So the Reckoning crew, we were all brought together by an assignment that we all were basically after to get our hands on a bit of gold. We were employed by three dwarven brothers to escort some supplies to the town of Ironwind. However, en route, they went on ahead of us by a day. We found that they had been kidnapped.
Ooh.
And then we got to Ironwind with their supplies, and then we had to find out where the hell they had gone. And that was the start of our adventure all that 10 months ago. And from there, we've led on to many, 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 many things. We found one of the dwarves, only to find out that what they were doing to begin with was that they were going to try and go to an old mine that belonged to their ancient ancestors. And there was a thing called the Forge of Spells there, where the dwarves used to use to create magical weapons. They wanted to reopen it and retake this mine that had been lost for centuries. So we helped, basically set out to help them through all sorts of craziness. And we fought a dragon on a hill because he was kind of being a trappy. And
did you die?
There's been a few. No one's died. There's been a few almost. The dragon was the toughest fight we've had so far. We had him in the middle of the campaign. And that we were fighting him essentially for a druid of the local forest who was kind of going to try and tell us where maybe one of these dwarfs was. So, yeah, it's kind of been drawn out to get these guys back in tow, but we did get there in the end.
That's good. So the thing is, I'm really curious about with all of these role-playing bits and pieces,
mm-hmm.
is what are the memories that have been created? So close your eyes. You've got 10 months' worth of content, mm-hmm. and you've been meeting, what, every month, every couple of weeks? What's sort of been the rough
I'd say we've probably had about a dozen sessions, so roughly every month, maybe a tiny bit sooner than that.
So when I say what's a standout, What is it that springs immediately to mind?
Well, I can tell you because I've got an entire list of them because I actually asked my group what are some of the standout moments.
I'm not asking about them, their standout.
Well, what's put it this way. There are two big bad guys that we've come up against so far. One was called Glassstaff. He was a leader of the Red Glen Butchers, which was a local gang in Ironwind who we'd found out was kidnapping children. And my character, Luther, not a big fan of that. He likes to protect them innocence.
Probably the monk was a fan of that, though.
No, he was also not a fan of that. No.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Either way, so Glassstaff, and then there was a drow by the name of the Spider, who was actually the one behind this whole thing and was like the big boss at the end of this chapter. Both of those guys we dispatched with relative ease. Glassstaff we actually beat without a fight.
Wow.
We took him down without having it. And the Spider we encased in a web and just all attacked him at once.
Ironic.
Yes, he tried to talk his way down and it just didn't work out. Also, myself as Luther and Mon, we have pretty much kicked open or bashed open every single door we've come across for an entire year because we just have, we're the two front runners with I've got my big sword, she's got a big warhammer, as well as big spiked armor, which she used to pretty much body slam everybody she finds, which she tried to do to a dragon's face. So that went down quite well. There was my wife, she, as Jade the Tabaxi, she talked down an entire army of bugbears from attacking us after we had just killed their leader.
Wow.
And they went on their merry way. So that was very, very nice of her.
Nice.
Yeah, so there's been lots of stuff like that. The last episode, we had Vess, our monk. He had an epic fight with another monk, or monkal combat, if you will. Where at the end of it, he killed the monk in the final blow, and when this monk fell to the ground, all the tattoos on this monk's arm disappeared off his and went onto Vess's arms.
Ooh. That's cool.
And we have no idea why.
All right, so my second question...
Yes.
...is how good is your GM?
How good is our GM? I don't know. He's more of a DM than a GM, to be perfectly honest.
He doesn't run the game. He's just running a dungeon. Doesn't sound like you've been in a dungeon.
No. John is very good. He's prepared a hell of a lot of props for this. He's written out things on bits of parchment. We've all had different sorts of letters we've been getting from different people. He always prints out a giant map that we have in the middle of the table. There's one for the town of Ironwind, as well as all the locations we go to. And we each have standees for where we're going on there. And, yeah, he does a hell of a lot of prep. And like I said, he's been doing this for a long time. And just one of the main reasons why this is set, his first adventure in Belforge they're going after, because he's actually a trained archaeologist. So that's where his mind goes to, because that's what he's grown up doing. So that's one of the things that he's melded into the campaign, that he built it originally around that and then has built other certain bits and bobs based off our characters and their background, like that drow fight with another monk. if we didn't already have a monk that was kind of seeking to balance the world out, that wouldn't have been there.
So that's what I wanted to ask, is what is the larger world setting? Is it set in a existing world? Is it set in something in Jonathan's mind? Because I know Jonathan, and he's an evil overlord in the real world.
Yes.
So it scares me that a world of totally his control, what he might end up doing.
It is 100% homebrew. He has come up with all of it himself. He might have taken some inspirations from lots of, possibly some D&D in the past that he's done, that obviously none of the rest of us at the table, who have only been playing it for, a lot of us, this is our first main campaign. Some of us have been playing it a couple of times.
Yeah, okay.
Well, because there's myself and Adam and Sarah, we'd never played before, I think, before we played with him. And then Josh had played a tiny bit before. Sam had played in a couple of campaigns over the year. This is the longest one he's ever been. And then John's partner, Kylie, she's kind of been the same thing as well. So this is the longest we've all done together. And yeah, all homebrew, and he's come up with everything so far. And he's pretty damn good on the fly when my character does ridiculous things like, I don't know, chasing after squirrels who happen to be called Mr. McNutt.
And this campaign, if I'm not wrong, Leon.
Yes.
This was your introduction into role-playing, wasn't it? And since you started this one, you've leapt into it with both hands, both feet, your head, your backside and everything else, and engage in a huge number of other campaigns, yet this one is still continuing. Is that right?
Yes, this is the one that we've done, put the most effort into. Mm. And yes, you should see my D&D shelf, which obviously didn't exist a year ago.
That's right.
It now has many a book and many a card and a die and whatever else on it. And it has inspired me to consider running my own campaign, which I hope to have a crack at sometime after I get back from the States, sometime in April.
Excellent. That's fantastic. Is there anything else you want to say before we throw to a song?
Well, I just did need to mention the fact that our Silas, that our ranger, has shot my character Luther in the back of the head twice by mistake.
But he hasn't killed him yet.
No, he damn well almost did kill me a few times. Oh, and there was one time where, as Luther, I drank a potion just off the floor because I thought it would be fun, and I became a balloon for an entire session. So they tied me to a rope, and they had a giant 8-foot Goliath balloon going around this cavern, which seemed to be fun and games.
How good was it when you were able to be released and went...
To be fair, I don't think that moment came. I'm pretty sure I just fell to the floor because it ran out in an instant.
And on that note...
Yes.
Where the Dice Men Cometh, it's Ed Radio 99.3 FM, and we're going to come back after this short song with Mark's story about role-playing, which has also been going on for a very long time. Yep. We'll be right back after this song.
Hello everyone, Mark here with a brief history lesson about patronage. Did you know that Cesare Borgia patronised Leonardo da Vinci? We all know where that ended up. That game he made about civilization building got bastardised into Small World, a game of cuddly races cuddling up against each other in cuddly mountain caves. And Chrétien de Troyes, or Troyes as you might know him, was patronised by Marie of France. Now, I used to call her French Mary when I knew her back in the 12th century. But again, another board game that was produced with patronage. How can you support patronage these days? Well, we've got this web-based thingy on the internet called Patreon. And by giving money to the Dice Men there, you allow us to create board gaming genius by way of media content, by way of your internet radio waves into your ears. And there's more, but we need more money to do it. If you support us on Patreon, you'll get paid back 1,000 times over in the content that we create. Or just feel good that you're helping 3 poor little people in Tasmania from having a hobby. We appreciate everything you do. We love you all. Thank you so much for supporting the Dice Men on Patreon. Getting paid back does not include real money. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, there you go. That was Holly Throsby with When You Sleep.
She must have fallen asleep right there at the end.
I think she forgot how to finish a song. You're with the Dice Men Cometh on Itch Radio 99.3 FM. We have but a few minutes to go.
Yes.
And Mark wants to recap a tale of woe. Woe. Woe.
Man dies 3 times in 1 night. A puzzling headline begins a front page article found in the Times of London. Three men, all identical in identification, were found dead in the same room of the Chelsea Arms Hotel. All were dispatched in a similar manner, stabbed through the heart. Then, the home of a valued friend burned to the ground, severely injuring him in the process. An odd summons, a surreptitious meeting, and a thousand-mile journey begin on the legendary rail service carrying the investigators to Constantinople, the gateway of the Orient. Horror on the Orient Express contains a massive and legendary campaign of up to 19 adventurers and more than 1,100 pages.
What?
For the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game. Beginning in 1920s London, the investigators journey to Paris and thence to the ancient city of Constantinople. With luck, they also return home.
Ha! Now, ha!
This is Horror on the Orient Express, run by Game Master Trent, ex-Dice Man Trent for us.
Not Dungeon Master?
Game Master. Oh, okay. He's just controlling the whole thing. I don't think we've come across any dungeons yet. And look, you can get this either in the PDF version or, as we have, in the boxed set luxury version. Now, I think it's no longer available. And it should be said that Mark Morrison, our good friend from Melbourne, the man who is the gnome treasurer, I believe, of campaign coins, but in his daytime job, he has been a Call of Cthulhu writer since the 80s. He's a huge part of this writing team. A core part of this campaign is, of course, the Simplon Orient Express that from 1919 onwards runs a southerly route from Calais to Paris to Milan, Venice, Trieste, Zagreb, Belgrade, Sofia and Istanbul.
Not Constantinople.
Do you know, Garth?
I do know, Garth.
That the westbound Orient Express became stuck in snow for 5 days in Chukotskoye. In real world times.
All I remember, it was stuck in Vinchenko or wherever we were last session.
Well, no, being stuck in snow for 5 days was the incident that inspired Agatha Christie's murder on the Orient Express. But we are adventurers, or in fact, ordinary people, really, who were called to London to go to a lecture by a Professor Beddoes.
I hate to tell you, I'm an ordinary. I'm Mariana. I am from Monaco. I'm an heiress.
Mm.
And I am an ass kicker.
You are. Well, whereas I am Luke Ekinson, a New Zealand farmer and high school teacher, but I've had some strange experiences in my life and it led me to venture forth to fight against the ancient evil that I know is out there, even though I don't see it very often. And, of course, we're joined by Douglas Lee Hoxton, our friend Aidan.
Mr. Mumbles.
Who is a crazed American postal worker. He's gone postal on a number of occasions, stabbing people in the eye with a fork again and again. And, sad to say, our friend Tony
dearly departed.
I can't even remember what his character name is because he died so early on. And look, let's face it, that is Call of Cthulhu. We left this adventure last week where I had no hit points, you had no hit points, Douglas Lee Hoxton had one hit point. So we had one hit point between the three of us. We don't know what's going to happen.
But the point is,
yes,
we managed to destroy something.
And something evil.
I know you're trying not to do any spoilers because the whole point of this is it is a role-playing campaign and it's all in the story.
It's a massive campaign that sees you travelling across Europe on the Orient Express on a journey to sort of reclaim some ancient evil, hopefully to destroy it at the end of the adventure. I don't know that I want to say much more than that, except that I don't think I have ever been engaged in a role-playing game, and I have been role-playing for many, 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 many years.
Well, you real life lived through the medieval ages.
That's right. Not. But I'm so engaged in this, I have a sad feeling that Luke Ekinson might be about to visit his demise. But, hey, you expect that to happen in a Call of Cthulhu campaign because you're always on the edge and you're facing unspeakable evils that we can't speak of.
But it's also, and look, I hate to do this, but I need to give credit to Trent. At the very start of this campaign, Trent laid it out very, very succinctly, which is that you're normal people potentially going up with god-like beings from the other blah, blah, blah. You're not expected to live.
Well, the fact that we've survived probably, I think we're more than halfway through, the fact that we've lived that long is a testament to how careful we have been.
Well, not to mention, I did have another character called Jan van Bort.
Oh, yeah.
That's he was Dutch. He didn't make it. He's still somewhere on some form of public transport, just going round and
it
round.
Goes
and
straight
round.
In London somewhere.
Yeah. So look, I do need to give credit to Trent because he makes so much of an effort. Every single campaign, we have an A4 page full of notes from the last session because, look, this has been going on for what 18 months.
Well, we only get to about every month. Sometimes even like 6 weeks.
Yes. So this has been an amazing campaign and we are kind of needing to draw it to a close because we've got another one that we need to do.
Is it going to be the mask of Nyarlathotep or is it going to be Invisible Sun?
It's going to be Invisible Sun. But look, on that note, we need to get out of here.
This has been an edit of The Dice Men Cometh from Edge Radio 99.3 FM, Hobart's independent youth station. Find us on Facebook and edgeradio.org.au.